Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. Chattanooga, Tennessee isn't known for its abundance of Jewish residents, so Joseph Paul Franklin figured the easiest way to find a synagogue was to look in the Yellow Pages. And there he landed on Beth Shalom Synagogue, which was just off the highway, so it would be easy to find. So anxious to visit, he drove past and made note of the temple's schedule for services, evening prayers, and upcoming special events. It was July 29, 1977, and Franklin was highly motivated to succeed in his one stated mission in life, to start a race war. He was white and ostensibly a Christian, and that, in his mind, was enough to ensure that his sworn enemies included all persons of color, as well as those who believed in a deity that was not named God and/or did not have a son Jesus who was said to have died for the very sins Joseph Paul Franklin was so willing to commit. Franklin also imagined the government to be his enemy, which made thwarting their rules and, later, robbing their federally insured institutions a mission perk. 4 days earlier, he had tried to blow up the Rockville, Maryland home of Jewish lobbyist and American-Israel Public Affairs Committee leader Morris Amitai. Franklin had succeeded in planting a bomb under the man's house, but had not been strategic in its placement. The family was unharmed, though their dog was sacrificed to Franklin's bigotry. He considered that a failure, and it was one reason he'd gotten out of D.C. quickly and headed south. It was also a valuable lesson well learned. By leaving immediately, he hadn't been caught. He intended this tour of Chattanooga to be similarly quick. He chose the synagogue and planted a bomb and stood watching from a distance. Rather fortuitously for those targeted, evening prayers ran short the night of July 29th, and while much of the building was destroyed, no one was still around when the bomb went off. It had all the markers of being a hate crime, so the feds were called in. Joseph Paul Franklin was already gone, en route to Atlanta, where he later said he planted a bomb in the Socialist Workers' Party offices. Discovered on August 1st, it had already been defused. A burning cigarette was the fuse, but it had fallen before igniting the dynamite when it was found. Three failed bombings must have given Franklin pause. At this rate, he wasn't going to go down in history as one of the world's great bombers. He was getting anxious to see some tangible results of his efforts. A skilled marksman who had grown up with guns, he shifted gears. Shooting those who offended him seemed a more surefire plan, no pun intended. He wanted some kind of divine intervention to tell him where to go next. Before we move forward with the story, though, I have to pause because there's a bit of tug of war throughout this man's killing career that I find interesting. That is, was the guy really on a mission from God to cleanse the earth of anyone not white and not Christian? Or was it something else? Dan Horn, a longtime Cincinnati reporter and a friend of mine, spoke to Franklin when he was on trial in Cincinnati in 1998. He said he has questions about this so-called mission.
I'd always wondered, especially after talking to him, if it was just some elaborate thing he built in his head to justify killing people because he liked to kill people. You know, I don't know. I don't doubt he was a racist. I don't doubt any of that. But in his head, maybe he needed some sort of justification to do what he was doing. But at the end of the day, I think he just liked killing people.
Whatever the motivation, at this point in our story, Franklin decided it was time to actually do that. He was off to Madison, Wisconsin. He hadn't picked Madison randomly. In fact, he had read about a local judge there who, while sentencing three black teenagers for the rape of a white girl, failed to impose what he considered a harsh enough sentence for the crime. To be clear, he wasn't the only one offended by Judge Archie Simonson's lenient sentence and the misogynistic remarks he made while passing judgment. According to the New York Times, the entire region was in turmoil over the judge's remarks, which amounted to, she was asking for it because the girl had been clothed, according to him, inappropriately at the time she was assaulted. The judge seriously asked in court, quote, should we punish a 15 or 16-year-old boy who reacts to it normally? End quote. Yeah, okay, pal. Now, Joseph Paul Franklin was not taking a feminist view when he balked at that. He was just angry that it was a crime against a white person perpetrated by black ones. And if that weren't enough, the judge was Jewish. So Franklin went to Madison to gun down Simonson. Two birds, one stone, if you will. But while stalking the judge, he stopped at a local shopping mall to get supplies. There, his car was temporarily blocked by another. Inside the other car was an interracial couple. Franklin got out of his car to, at first, rage at the black driver and his white female companion, and then he decided to just shoot them both. The two deaths were never planned nor discreet. It was daytime. The mall was busy. People had seen him, and they'd seen what had happened. As I said, the only lesson he had learned so far in his one-man hate spree was to get the hell moving out of town and keep moving. Make it hard for the cops to find you or know what you're going to do next. So he took off. He was still on his anti-Semitic bent and figured he needed another synagogue to optimize the victim count. This time, he found himself in the suburbs of St. Louis in front of the Brith Shalom Knesset Israel congregation, conveniently located near Interstate 64 and 170 for his planned quick exit. Across the highway, behind a wealth of trees, he made a sniper's nest and fashioned a stable sling so he could rest his semi-automatic hunting rifle and limit its recoil. On October 8, 1977, he parked his car, took a guitar case that was holding his rifle out of his trunk, hopped on a stolen bike, and cycled up to his nesting spot, and waited. Soon enough, the 200-plus invitees that had just witnessed the joyful bar mitzvah of Ricky Kalina spilled out of the temple and in his line of telescopic sight. He fired. At first, they were frozen, then panicked, then horrified as three of their number who had just been idly talking in the parking lot surrounded by their small children were felled by his bullets. Gerald Gordon, age 42, died on the spot. No one saw the shooter who, by the time the police were called, had already ditched his gun and was back on the road. Joseph Paul Franklin was just getting started. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Vinted. I was on Vinted recently and I found actual 90s grunge pieces and had a full identity crisis over the fact that I didn't save any of my own stuff from back then.
A big thank you to today's sponsor, Vinted, for that reminder that you used to have great taste and then got rid of all of it.
Exactly. But it actually got me looking at my own closet differently. I've got clothes that just don't fit anymore, sitting there doing nothing, and I finally decided to list some of them on Vinted instead of just letting them pile up.
How is that, actually listing stuff?
Way easier than I expected. You just take a few photos, write a quick description, and it's up. And there are no seller fees, so whatever it sells for, I actually get to keep every dollar.
That's a big deal. A lot of people don't realize how much of their sale price usually gets eaten up elsewhere.
Right, and once something sells on Vinted, they generate the prepaid shipping label for you automatically, so you're not even dealing with the annoying part.
So it's basically clean out your closet, make some money, and someone else gets to have their own why didn't I keep this moment down the line.
Exactly. If you've got stuff sitting in your closet that you keep saying you'll wear but never do, go see what it's worth on Vinted.
Ready to clean out your closet and make some extra money? Download the Vinted app for free and start listing. With no seller fees, you keep every dollar you earned. And for a limited time, enjoy free shipping in the U.S. on Vinted.
Vinted. Go download it and go dig through your own closet. Joseph Paul Franklin wasn't born with that name. It's one he chose, and legally acquired as an adult, to honor the two men he most admired. The first was Paul Joseph Goebbels, Adolf Hitler's propaganda minister. The second was Benjamin Franklin. For the record, no one has nailed down why he liked Ben so much. I'm pretty sure Ben would have been disappointed had they met. Anyway, he was born James Clayton Vaughn Jr., the son of two deeply flawed parents who were both mean alcoholics who were viciously abusive and otherwise neglectful of their four children. According to biographers Jack Rosewood and Dwayne Walker, quote, "The Vaughn parents reserved most of their vitriol for their children, and it was Jr. who received the brunt of the abuse," end quote. The violence was random and severe. So was the deprivation of both nourishment and love. Growing up in different parts of Alabama just after the Second World War, moving around a lot because of his father's unreliable work habits. Many sources list Franklin's hometown as being Birdtown, Alabama, a town that doesn't actually exist, according to Google. It might be a small, unincorporated community called Byrd, B-Y-R-D, located in Marion County, Alabama, or it might be referring to any number of several neighborhoods around Mobile. I don't know. But during investigations into his later crimes, and maybe using Franklin's own words, Detective Mike O'Brien of the Cincinnati Police Department described Birdtown this way.
Basically, one side of the track is black and the other side is white. And so there was a lot of racial tension in his upbringing. There was a lot of problems between whites and blacks in that area. His mother had relatives that had been in World War II on the side of Nazi Germany.
It might surprise you that Franklin's early teachers saw no signs of the unrepentant serial killer that was to come. They found his conduct good and his grades even better. When he was 7, he had a bike accident, which made him lose the vision in one of his eyes, a condition that was likely caused because his parents had not gotten him the medical care he needed. After that, he was legally blind and punished for it. Now, you may have noticed I called Franklin a serial killer. That's because he fits the definition, a person who kills serially, not all at the same time and place. That's different from a mass murderer who, like school shooters, for example, kill many people all at once. Funny thing was, Franklin would later explicitly reject the serial killer label. Early on in this clip, you'll hear forensic psychologist Dr. Chris Mohandi ask him to explain his reasoning.
Prefer the term multiple slayer. And the difference to you is what?
Well, the serial killer has that connotation of Ted Bundy, you know, and Henry Lee Lucas, or whatever that wacko's name is, a crazy bastard that killed all those women in Texas. You know, people like that, you know, sex killers. And I was not a sex killer. You know, I didn't go around raping women and murdering them. You know, wasn't my MO, my style.
Ralph Eccles, author of Life Without Mercy, a book that deals with one aspect of Franklin's killing career, thinks Franklin rejected the term for other reasons.
He never thought of himself as a serial killer. He was a man on a mission from God.
So he said. But back to Franklin's early life in Alabama before he could lay claim to such high purpose. As a youngster, many noticed tendencies that we would later call obsessive-compulsive disorder, something that might explain his persistence at being skilled in target hunting, even while visually impaired, so he could impress those who showed so little faith in him. He was not a joiner. Instead, he turned to books to help him escape from reality, one in which neither his parents nor his peers seemed to welcome his presence. He was often left to his own devices. He was 15 when he stole and read a copy of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf to help him flesh out his beliefs in the superiority of one race above all others. He then decided, at 16, he was done with school. He was a young man without foundation, no support to count on, and no teachers to guide him. He wandered through New Age spiritualism and thought of becoming a Mooney for a while, as in a member of the Unification Church, but they were too accepting of others for his taste. He dabbled in the Christian identity movement, which held that those of Jewish faith were not to be regarded as human. Read the Old Testament, they said. He married briefly to 16-year-old Bobby Louise Dorman, but his violence toward her quickly put an end to the union. He heard the American Nazi movement beckon, bought in for a bit, but left when he found it not the right fit. He moved on to joining the National States Rights Party and wasn't happy with their progress either, so he enlisted with the Alabama-based United Klans of America. The problem Franklin seemed to have with all these racially divisive groups was simple. All they did was talk a good game. Yeah, they might burn a few crosses, but he wanted to know, where was the action plan? When were they going to go to war to stop the desegregation of the nation, the busing of white children to inferior schools, the intermixing of blood by marriage? It was 1976, the nation's bicentennial year, when he officially became Joseph Paul Franklin and enrolled in a Klan boot camp, where he learned how to make pipe bombs and got even sharper with his sharpshooting skills. Now, you might be wondering why he didn't go to Vietnam, but rest assured, he wanted to. He was all for killing some Vietnamese, but his designation as legally blind ended that dream. In 1977, however, he managed to get himself into the Alabama National Guard, where he learned a few wartime skills, like first aid as administered in the field. And then he schooled himself on how to be an effective assassin. He adopted a string of aliases, created a pocket full of bogus driver's licenses, and collected different states' license plates. He bought a few wigs, different glasses, and tinted makeup so he could change his appearance. He also acquired the insight that individual jurisdictions, from small cities to even statewide authorities, rarely shared their intel. This was before there was a lot of video surveillance and before it was easy to share whole sheafs of digital documents. It was also before a lot of forensic advancements, before DNA profiling, and before 9/11, when we got more organized about homeland security. And it was before the 24-hour news cycle as we know it today. It's why the 1970s through the 1990s are sometimes referred to as the golden age or epidemic years of serial killers. And it's not just me saying this. A study by Radford University and Florida Gulf Coast University analyzing its own serial killer database found that the number of known active serial killers peaked in the 70s and 80s at around 300. Think Jeffrey Dahmer, BTK, Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy. But by the 2010s, there were fewer than 50. Technology did much of that. Franklin didn't have such data to analyze, of course, but he knew that if he could roam quietly through random towns, leave no fingerprints, and avoid consistent eyewitness IDs, he could kill his enemies without much fear of being found out. The most effective way to do that was to have no home base, to rob banks capriciously along the way, and, if pressed, donate plasma for spending money. He made sure to stay in no-name hotels, use only cash, limit his attachments, even if that meant he had to occasionally pay for sex, and change guns and cars like underwear. He believed that once he started to eliminate Jewish and Black people, other whites would follow his lead, and he would be a hero for the ages. It was that following summer of 1977 that he went to Maryland, then to Chattanooga, to Atlanta, Madison, and St. Louis. During this time, he grew envious of other serial killers operating at the time, like Son of Sam or Bundy, who were getting more press than he. If he was going to start this race war, he was going to have to make people notice. Sometime during all this, he sent then-presidential candidate Jimmy Carter a letter. It's never been published in full that I could find, but the gist was, how dare a fellow Southerner be so interested in racial equality? The letter was threatening, but vaguely so. The Secret Service and the FBI were informed. It's unclear if he ever meant to kill the president, but did seem happy, at least for now, to settle on someone he decided was equally vile. He had picked up a copy of Hustler, the raunchier, more blue-collar alternative to Playboy, which liked to pretend its readers were only there for the interviews. You might remember that Hustler founder Larry Flint appealed to readers' interests with less concern for censorship or offense. As a result, he was often the subject of obscenity lawsuits targeting the sale of porn, an issue that was, per Flint and others, a violation of his First Amendment rights. But imagine Franklin finding, much to his incandescent rage, images in the most current edition featuring an interracial couple, nude and intertwined. If he killed Larry Flint, people would notice. As luck would have it, Flint was very visible in early 1978, fighting one of those local obscenity charges in Lawrenceville, Georgia, just outside of Atlanta. During that trial, he and his attorney, Gene Reeves, had a habit of lunching at the same diner every day. Franklin could work with that. Once in Lawrenceville, he found an empty building across from the diner where he could lie in wait. On March 6, 1978, Judge Huell Harrison called the lunch recess. Franklin aimed his .44 caliber rifle at the diner's front door and waited for the two men to exit back to the street. Coverage from news station 11 Alive.
Lawrenceville attorney Gene Reeves was on the sidewalk in a pool of blood. Ambulance crews had picked up Flint moments earlier. He had been shot once in the stomach. The bullet which hit Reeves had apparently gone through an arm and slammed into his side. Flint had spent all morning on the witness stand and was due up again in a few minutes until the shots rang out. Even people who were only a few feet away weren't positive what had happened.
Did you see anybody running away that like it might have been the gunman?
I seen one person running around the corner, and he was going so fast you couldn't really tell what he looked like.
Flint and Reeves were rushed into the emergency room at Button Gwinnett Hospital. Flint was conscious, but barely.
Judge Harrison declared a mistrial. The March 7th edition of the Atlanta Constitution quoted a hospital spokesman saying both men were in critical but stable condition. The story, reported by several members of the Constitution staff, described the incident as, quote, extremely confused. Police said they had no suspects, even though the shooting took place during lunch hour on a main Lawrenceville street, end quote. The Hustler publisher, who had just publicly declared his own newfound Christianity, had said in court that morning he planned to make major changes to Hustler. Some believed he might have even been inching towards shuttering it. The shooting was said to have changed his mind on that and on his newfound Christianity. In any case, he had taken a bullet to his stomach for the cause. The result was a severed spinal cord that left him paralyzed for the rest of his life. Reeves survived as well. According to Franklin's biographers, the shooter nearly broke one of his cardinal rules after that murder attempt. So angry was he that he had not succeeded in killing Flint that he entertained the idea of going to the hospital and finishing him off. But he decided the larger goal was to put the mission ahead of his personal desires. If he couldn't kill Flint for photographing mixed-race couples, the least he could do was start killing them. He went back to Chattanooga. At a Pizza Hut, he killed a black man and injured the white female he dined with. Months later, he'd kill a black Taco Bell manager in Atlanta for employing white women, and a few months after that, he would kill another black man at a Burger King in Virginia. Between the Flint shooting and the fast food fatalities, he had time to find a second wife. She knew him as James Cooper, a high-end plumber who claimed to have a lot of out-of-town jobs. He would come home occasionally with a wad of cash and leave just after he'd beaten her up. His brand of love was hard to understand. So was his brand of hate. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by ZBiotics. I am so excited for this sponsor because Scott and I have been drinking ZBiotics for years now. It is straight up part of our routine before we go out.
Oh yeah, I can confirm. It's non-negotiable in the house. If we're going out, pre-alcohol comes with us.
ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic.
It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drink.
Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut.
It's a buildup of this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for rough days after drinking.
Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down.
Just remember to make pre-alcohol your first drink of the night. Drink responsibly and you'll feel your best tomorrow.
If I have anything to do the day after an outing, like running errands, writing a podcast script, recording, Z-Biotics is a must.
Wedding season, bachelorettes, rooftop birthdays, August doesn't slow down and neither do we.
Pre-alcohol keeps it that way. Go to zbiotics.com/COTC, code COTC for 15% off. Joseph Paul Franklin was getting frustrated. Where was the media when he needed them to publicize his cause? By now, he had killed and bombed his way halfway across the map and shot the country's most notorious pornographer in broad daylight. It had made headlines, but none of it had made him or his cause famous. And nobody was connecting the dots, because Franklin wasn't telling anyone what the dots were. If he wanted to start a race war, someone needed to actually notice one was starting. Maybe if he killed someone famous and black, people would ask why. He decided the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who was headquartered in Chicago with his Operation Push, was the perfect target. Franklin began heading that way, but as he traveled through Indiana, he somehow discovered that Jackson wasn't in Chicago. Angered by the change of plans, he then struck upon a bit of luck. Vernon Jordan happened to be in Fort Wayne. Jordan had been a rising star in the civil rights fight just after he graduated from law school when he was part of the team of attorneys who desegregated the University of Georgia. Later, he headed up the New York City-based National Urban League, a nonprofit organization which worked for social and economic justice for Black Americans. It was in this capacity that he was in Fort Wayne that late May day when he crossed paths with a man who hated everything he stood for. Jordan was staying at a Marriott that was situated next to a freeway in a room that opened to the street. Franklin set up in a hidden pocket across the freeway and waited with his loaded .30-06 rifle beside him. Now, I'm not a gun expert, so I did what a reasonable person would do and Googled it. According to ammunition2go.com, that gun has unmatched versatility and hard-hitting energy. It launches standard 150 to 180 grain bullets at 2,700 to 2,900 feet per second. It's often used in big game hunting and has, quote-unquote, manageable recoil. In the vernacular, then, Franklin was armed to take down a bear. In the early morning of May 29th, 1980, Jordan returned to his hotel room in the company of a white woman. As he went to unlock his hotel room door, he was shot in the back. Franklin did not shoot his target's companion. He stole away back to his car and hit the freeway.
The family and friends of Vernon Jordan were jolted awake early this morning to the news that he had been shot and critically wounded. His mother, other family members, and longtime friend and associate Lyndon Wade, head of Atlanta's Urban League, left Hartsfield Airport at 10 o'clock this morning. We do not know whether one or two bullets struck Jordan and whether they were from a rifle or a pistol. We do not know who did it. According to hospital spokesman, the bullet or bullets was a rare fragmenting type, and the placement of the shot was well aimed, leading to speculation that the shooting was more than just a random incident.
Franklin could no longer say no one was paying attention to him. In a strange twist, the attempted murder of Vernon Jordan was among the very first news stories covered by a brand spanking new news network that had just debuted. The network was CNN. But as for Franklin's cause? Well, for some reason, immediately after the ambush, the Fort Wayne police would insist that the shooting had not been racially motivated. You know, maybe they were naive, or maybe they wanted to quell trouble they saw brewing. It didn't matter to the literal-minded Franklin. He took their dismissal as a personal challenge to do more and do better and be clearer in his intent. A week later, he was in Cincinnati, trolling for his next target. He stayed clear of the all-black neighborhoods where his presence might be noticed and remembered, sticking closer to those parts of town that were racially mixed. There, he knew he would find the mixed-race couples he particularly loathed. He found a hidden high-overhead perch that looked over railroad tracks in the Bond Hill area of town and set up shop there on June 8th. Around 11:30 or so that night, he saw two black men walking down the tracks. Franklin would later confess it all to a Hamilton County assistant prosecutor named Melissa Powers.
I did it. The only thing I can say is I did do it.
And can you also tell me why you did it?
I was trying to get rid of all the ugly people in the world.
Okay.
And
why did you select?
I considered the blacks the ugliest people of all.
Powers asked for particulars, and Franklin was happy to fill in the blanks for her. This replaying of the videotaped confession aired on Cincinnati TV station WCPO.
I just put the gun right on the biggest dude first, fired one shot with that .44 Magnum. I just heard somebody go make a sound like they just got shot. And as soon as the other guy bolted, it was just like through a miracle that I got him, man. I did not even aim the gun at him. As soon as he heard that shot, he just bolted and started running. And I aimed the gun without even, just in the dark there, just hoping that I would get a lucky shot and hit him, And sure enough, it actually got him.
But his victims hadn't been men. They were 13-year-old Dante Brown and his cousin, 14-year-old Daryl Lane, who had been walking from their grandmother's house to a convenience store when they were slaughtered. Cincinnati Detective O'Brien explained to the producers of the FBI Files TV show that
the coroner responded to the scene, and he had already performed a postmortem examination on one of the young men and was able to tell the trajectory and the direction the shots were fired in.
The coroner returned and pointed police toward the train trestle 75 feet away. The gun used was determined to be a .44 Ruger carbine rifle. They also had a few probable sightings of the man in Bond Hill. It wasn't much, but it was something. O'Brien reported that the crime alarmed even the cops.
This wasn't the typical homicide. When you have two children, 13, 14-year-old children, that are shot sniper-style shooting with no clear motive, two children on their way to a candy store. It obviously had the city and the neighborhood in an uproar.
Immediately after the killings, Franklin hightailed it to his Northern Kentucky motel room. Cincinnati sits on the Ohio River, which separates Ohio from the Bluegrass State, and was getting ready to vamoose when he decided he was low on ready cash and he'd sell a few items by way of classified ad. So he sat tight until a woman who had agreed to the purchase came to the motel and picked up her goods, only to have Franklin ask if she also wanted to buy a gun. The woman declined, but was so discomforted by his demeanor and by his offer that she figured it was just a smart thing to write down his license plate number and the make of his automobile. You never know. Franklin stopped in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, where he killed an interracial couple as he waited in a sniper's perch on a bridge over the Conemaugh River. 10 days later, in June of 1980, Franklin killed two female hitchhikers in West Virginia who told him they had dated black men or had no problem with anyone who did. He shot them and left them by the side of the road. Later, he would, with a certain amount of pride, say, "Hey, at least he wasn't a rapist." No one is sure why, but Franklin then headed west until he drove into Salt Lake City. Despite the fact that the city, and the state of Utah for that matter, had one of the lowest black populations per capita anywhere in America, he figured it was time they had their chance to get into this race war he was trying so hard to foment. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Quince. August always feels like the right time to reset the routine after a busy summer, and for me, that started with my bed.
You've been very vocal about this, for the record.
Because it's true. Our Quince sheets are genuinely so cozy, and they actually fit our mattress properly, which sounds like a small thing, but if you've ever fought with sheets that pop off the corner of a thick mattress at 2 a.m., you know that's a real problem solved.
They're organic cotton, right?
Exactly, and Quince isn't just bedding either. I got a pair of their pajamas recently, and I'm obsessed. And then Scott fell in love with him, so I got him a pair too. And here's Scott getting his pajamas.
Oh, Quince! Oh, thank you! Oh, I love those pajamas. I've been jealous. Oh, I love it.
I use Quince, and you should too. The bedding, the PJs, all of it.
Quince does home, cookware, all kinds of elevated essentials, and everything's priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands because they cut out the middleman and work directly with ethical factories.
Upgrade your everyday. Download the Quince app for app-exclusive offers or go to quince.com/centuries. Get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/centuries. At this point in his killing spree, Joseph Paul Franklin figured he was outdoing all those big-talking American Nazis and white-hooded Klansmen. He was getting the job done. But aside from the CNN debut event and the formal coverage by other national networks, he still didn't think he was getting his due. Biographer Eccles thinks this was, in some way, part of his delusional and self-important point of view. In the summer of 1980 wasn't exactly a year in which nothing happened. There was the Olympic boycott, a deadly nationwide heat wave, the catastrophic eruption of Mount St. Helens, and the release of both Pac-Man and George Lucas's The Empire Strikes Back. Eccles said almost exactly what Dan Horn had wondered at the top of this episode.
Ostensibly, he wanted to start a race war, but in actual fact, during his so-called mission, he was robbing banks for a living and killing people for a hobby. I think he had to dress up what he was doing in ideological terms. He had to make it grander than what it was.
Mission or no, Franklin carried on, getting to Salt Lake City in mid-August. He must have been tired, or perhaps less wrapped up in his usual obsessive need to control every detail of his crimes, because while he used an alias to check into the Siesta Motel, he hadn't changed his license plate and actually wrote that plate on his motel registration card. He roamed the usual spots around town, then stopped to pick up a sex worker named Mickey. Before they even got to his motel room, as biographers Rosewood and Walker wrote, quote, he began to talk about his racial beliefs and quiz the young prostitute about where black pimps live and where he could find interracial couples. Franklin then went on to offer to kill Mickey's pimp and brag that he had killed several blacks as he was a hitman for the Ku Klux Klan, end quote. He told her name was John Hagman. They completed their business, but not before he showed her his guns and drove her home and met her roommate. He was soon enough back to work, looking for those he wanted dead. He found a good spot to hide and wait in a section of town called Liberty Park. Two young black men and two even younger white women appeared to be taking a run together through the park. One of the girls had apparently casually dated one of the men, but really, this was just four friends out enjoying the night air on August 20th, 1980. Terry Jackson Mitchell was just 15 and told the FBI Files producers that while she and her girlfriend, Karma Ingersoll, had been running alone, they were approached by a white man in a brown Camaro who asked them to get in his car. They noticed he had a gun by him on the passenger seat. They managed to get away, figuring he was just some creep. They caught up to their male friends. 18-year-old David Martin and 20-year-old Ted Fields slowed their pace and said they would deal with any more creeps that came along. The foursome was still together when, sometime between 10 and 10:15 p.m., Martin suddenly fell to the ground. Jackson Mitchell remembers,
Dave said, they got me. And I thought it was, you know, a funny joke for a second. But when I looked at him and he started to fall and we, you know, tried to catch him, and the blood was everywhere. And I looked at the street. I think I went into shock.
Both men were shot and both died at the scene, but not before they told the girls to run. This time, Franklin hadn't gotten away cleanly. A few people saw a man put something in the trunk of his car. They even remembered it was a 1975 Camaro, brown with red pinstripes, chrome wheels, dual exhausts, and a spoiler before zipping out of the park. Curtis Jensen, the FBI special agent in charge in Salt Lake City, remembers hearing about the incident in Liberty Park.
When I first heard about this case, I was incensed. It caused a great deal of concern among not just the black community, but all of the community in Salt Lake City. They felt that there was an assassin loose and it could happen again.
The feds joined the Salt Lake cops and helped determine that the weapon used had been a six-shot rifle. They then spoke to gun shops and tested a variety of weapons to find the make and type used to kill the two runners. Now, in the wake of Ted Bundy, there was a growing understanding that killers could elude authorities because there had been no jurisdictional sharing. So, investigators decided to change the game. They sent out a nationwide teletype alerting every law enforcement division in the country of the double homicide. The notice also came with a $25,000 reward offered up by one of the victim's employers and other local business people for information leading to the arrest of the offender. Thousands of leads came in. One was from a woman who seemed credible but was very apprehensive about coming forward. Once contacted by lead SLPD Detective Don Bell and assured she would not be prosecuted for taking money in exchange for sex, Mickey agreed to talk. She remembered the date of their encounter, the motel, the guns she had seen, and the claims her client had made. She also told police that he had two tattoos. The one on his left forearm was of an American eagle, and the one on his right forearm, a depiction of the Grim Reaper. She could not ID the gun, but she remembered a roommate had met the guy when he had taken her home. The roommate happened to be an artist, and soon enough, working with police sketch artists and Mickey, the FBI and the Salt Lake Police had a face. A revised and updated teletype went out, and soon Cincinnati police called and explained that two young black men had been gunned down in their town at night with no clue as to who or why. That had been just 2 months before. The cops from the two different departments met up, and the feds joined them. Comparing notes from eyewitnesses on the ground in both cities, both factions came away feeling they were that much closer to finding this guy. The cops now spread out, trailing this freshly sketched guy with the tats via handwriting comparisons on registration cards to eight different motels across the state. He had been just 9 blocks from Liberty Park on the day of the shootings. He had left a single fingerprint on one of the cards. The plot was thickening. Franklin apparently loved that Camaro because he hadn't given it up yet. The two survivors of the Liberty Park attack remembered the license plate number on it, and despite Franklin fudging the license plate number on those motel registration slips, he didn't count on one particularly fastidious motel owner. Bell again.
He must have been in his late 70s, early 80s. He went out every night around 3 o'clock in the morning and would take all of his motel registration slips and walk by all the cars and check their license plate numbers against what were put on the cards because he was so sure that his guests were going to steal a pillow or pillowcase.
The Camaro had Kentucky plates. The older innkeeper had manually written down the correct information on the plate alongside the fake one that Franklin had written down. The SLPC called their new best friends in Cincinnati, who called around the tri-state area and found the registered owner of the car in Louisville, who had sold the car to Franklin. He even had the sales receipt. Franklin had used a false name, of course, but the seller recognized the man in the sketch as the same guy. The only thing they could do now was issue a nationwide warrant for, of all things, defrauding an innkeeper. It went out to almost 60,000 law enforcement agencies. Law enforcement was now lining up bank robberies with Franklin's movements. The cops were learning and moving fast, But Franklin was moving faster. He decided to return to Cincinnati, a now familiar hunting ground, to kill some more. He parked himself in another Northern Kentucky motel and, on the night of September 25th, was not pleased to be kept awake by a random commotion outside his door. It was the cops, for goodness sake, but they weren't after him. They were swarming to arrest a robbery suspect who had also chosen the motel to hide out. Peeved by the disturbance, Franklin called the manager's office and complained. And hey, they were also blocking his access to his own car. Tell these guys to move. The commotion went on unabated. Franklin called the desk again and again. The manager seemed to move too slowly for him, so he then called the Florence, Kentucky police to tell them to move their cars. The cops on site then ran the Camaro's plates and voila, the complainant had a warrant out for his arrest. Franklin went quietly. He left his arsenal behind in the motel room. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Talkiatry.
If you've ever tried to find a psychiatrist who actually takes your insurance and were told to wait months or that they're not accepting new patients, you're not alone.
Talkiatry makes it possible to see a licensed psychiatrist online who takes your insurance in just a few days.
This isn't therapy. It's psychiatry. You're seeing an actual medical provider who can diagnose mental health conditions and prescribe medication when it's appropriate.
Talkiatry is a 100% online psychiatry practice, comprehensive evaluations, diagnoses, and ongoing medication management for things like ADHD, anxiety, depression, and more. Getting started only takes a few minutes. A short online assessment matched with a clinician who fits what you need, and your first visit scheduled in days, not months.
And because you stick with the same provider over time, you're not re-explaining everything at every visit. Your care actually evolves with you.
More than 300,000 patients have already found psychiatric care through Talkiatry this way.
Head to talkiatry.com/COTC to complete your short assessment and get matched with an in-network psychiatrist in just a few minutes.
That's talkiatry.com/COTC to get matched in minutes.
Talkiatry.com/COTC.
Joseph Paul Franklin sat handcuffed in an interrogation room. He would later explain that he had prayed to the Lord and lo and behold, when the detective asking him a few questions left to call Cincinnati police about this recent arrest, another guy came into the room and uncuffed him. The Lord had listened. Franklin climbed out of a window and disappeared. The embarrassed FBI wasted no time. They issued a warrant for unlawful flight, made him a suspect in murders in seven states, had agents watch Franklin's wife's address, and promoted him immediately to the top 10 wanted list. They issued the sketch, descriptions of the tattoos, and his numerous aliases everywhere they thought he might turn up, like at post offices, banks, and blood and plasma donation centers. Having checked their own files, the feds were especially concerned that Franklin was headed to Florida, where President Carter was campaigning hard to be reelected. On October 28th, a very alert blood bank employee in Lakeland, Florida, recognized him.
Franklin was arrested late Tuesday when FBI agents played a hunch that paid off.
We know from past history that this individual did frequent blood banks to sell his plasma. We left the flyer, and we did receive a phone call from the blood bank 6 hours after we left the flyer saying a person fitting that description was in, not the same name. But through fingerprint examination, he was identified as being a fugitive.
Franklin had gone to the bank to sell his plasma. The employee there waylaid him long enough to get police and FBI in place, and he was again taken into custody. While in the Lakeland jail, he made a phone call to his wife, during which he admitted he had killed those two men in Utah. He was then flown to Salt Lake City to face federal civil rights violation charges. While safely behind bars, Franklin confided in fellow inmate Robert Herrera, and he, in turn, made a deal for himself before telling the feds everything Franklin had confessed to. specifically to the Salt Lake City double killings, a few other random murders, and a slew of bank robberies. I normally don't trust jailhouse informants, but Franklin really did seem to like to hear himself confess. Franklin's first federal trial began on February 24, 1981. During a lunch intermission, he was put in a conference room alone. He easily removed the locked door's hinges and made it down a hall and into the ventilation ductwork that ran throughout the courthouse. He was found there an hour or so later and was returned to the courtroom without the jury ever being told he had spent lunch crawling around above them. That trial lasted 7 days and included the testimony of some 80 witnesses, including his wife, who recounted their late October phone call.
The 30-year-old Mobile, Alabama native was characterized by the prosecution as a pathological loner and a man so consumed with hatred for blacks that killing them was too good for them. Franklin, throughout the proceedings, maintained his innocence, although he did say the blacks did deserve to die for race mixing.
On March 4th, the verdict came.
Franklin stood motionless as he heard the court clerk read guilty to both counts of civil rights violations. The all-white, 10-woman, 2-man jury returned the verdict after 13 and a half hours of deliberation.
He was given 2 life sentences and sent to Marion Federal Penitentiary in Illinois. He was eventually placed in solitary confinement there for his own safety. In 1982, he was tried for attempted murder in Vernon Jordan's shooting, but he was acquitted. The all-white federal jury in Indiana said there wasn't enough evidence to prove guilt. Franklin went back to prison. A decade passed. I imagine he got tired of not talking to anybody, so sometime in the early 1990s, he decided he would confess some things. Vernon Jordan's shooting, for one, he admitted he'd done it after all. Double jeopardy meant he couldn't be convicted of it. Franklin also confessed to the murders of the 2 West Virginia hitchhikers and to the St. Louis synagogue shooting. For that one, which had killed Gerald Gordon 20 years earlier, Franklin was tried in Missouri and sentenced to death in 1997. He was then transferred from federal prison to Missouri's Potosi Correctional Center in Mineral Point. Franklin seemed to like the attention of all these law enforcement types trying to clear their cold cases. He liked traveling to other places and talking to new people. It sure beat solitary confinement. It also fed his considerable desire to keep spewing his hate. On those trips, agents noticed he would refuse food if he thought that a black person had a hand in preparing it. In 1998, after years of insisting he had nothing to do with the killing of the 2 kids in Cincinnati, the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office there had the idea to send Melissa Powers, then a young, pretty, blonde assistant prosecutor, to see if she could pry anything out of him. Cincinnati Police Detective Mike O'Brien had spent 17 years trying to get Franklin to talk about the crime. When Powers walked into the conference room with him, tape recorder on, he confessed without much prelude. Powers later said she plied him with flattery, and he quickly buckled. He was brought back to Cincinnati and put on trial in October 1998. Court TV broadcast the entire trial. Here's Common Pleas Court Judge Ralph Winkler reading the verdict, which had been reached after just 45 minutes of jury deliberation.
Very well. Will the defendant please rise? I will read the verdicts as recorded by this jury. As to count number 1, we the jury in the issue joined find the defendant Joseph Paul Franklin guilty of aggravated murder as charged in 1 count of the indictment signed by all members of the jury. As to count number 2, we the jury in the issue joined find the defendant Joseph Paul Franklin guilty of aggravated murder is charged in count 2 of the indictment.
Reporter Dan Horn spoke to Franklin just after the verdict and before sentencing while he was a reporter at the now-defunct Cincinnati Post. He remembers his conversation taking an odd turn.
He kind of liked talking about it. And when he described the crimes themselves, his voice shifted a little. He sounded different. He sounded, frankly, a little excited about reliving that moment. Uh-huh. His voice is kind of, it almost went down at a half an octave or something. You know, he just kind of really got in the moment and was kind of enjoying remembering that, which didn't make me feel particularly great, but that was kind of where he was at. And I guess I can't say I was surprised by that.
Franklin was given two consecutive life sentences in Ohio, but was quickly returned to Missouri's death row. Asked about Franklin's intent, you know, that whole race war thing, Dan wondered why, if he was serious, he didn't leave some sort of calling card back at the sniper's nests, which were almost always found. Why didn't he announce his desires? Were we all supposed to just make sense of his personal puzzle? It seems a good question. A strange little aside here, Dan Horn is famous, at least to anyone in Cincinnati newsrooms, for covering Larry Flint for decades. Flint had built his porn kingdom in Cincinnati long before he became a national figure. So it seemed fair to ask Dan about Flint's take on Franklin. That was, by the way, a crime that Franklin admitted to but was never tried for. Dan said that Flint believed Franklin was responsible for trying to kill him and for putting him into a wheelchair for the rest of his life.
When people would kind of question his First Amendment cred, he would say stuff like, well, how many people got shot for it?
As far as remorse, Dan says Franklin had none. But a few days before he was executed, Franklin gave a self-serving interview to CNN's Kyung La, who asked him if he had any regrets about the killings.
No, I don't really think about them. I mean, I can't go back and think about the cases, you know, individually. I have too much other problems, too much other things I have to focus on and worry about, you know.
Those are two young boys, just 13 and 14 years old.
Yeah, it was, I regret the fact that I shot them now.
Why did you shoot them?
Well, I was just waiting. I was sitting on that railroad track waiting for the first either interracial couple or black to walk by.
And what was your mission?
Well, to try to get a race war started, mixed race couples and blacks. I figured if once I started doing it and showed them how, other white supremacists would do the same thing, follow suit. You know,
so you hope people would copy you?
I would hope, I hope that other white nationalists would do the same thing.
Do you think you're a hero to those hate groups?
Well, that's what they tell me, you know.
He repeated those claims to Hate Watch at the Southern Poverty Law Center in a series of telephone interviews. He claimed that, quote, I was always having dreams on the streets telling me to do things. I always felt they were messages from God, so I would obey them, end quote. He was executed by lethal injection on November 20th, 2013. The state action was delayed by 6 hours because of his lawyer's efforts to get a judge to intervene on the grounds that Franklin's mental competence was in question. They posited he was a paranoid schizophrenic. He may have been, or perhaps he'd just been carefully laying the groundwork for that when talking to Hate Watch. In one of his final acts, he called Salt Lake City survivor Terry Jackson Mitchell to say he was glad he hadn't killed her. She said she was sorry he had had such a horrible childhood, but had no issue with the execution going ahead. Larry Flint had always been a vocal opponent of the death penalty, calling it nothing more than vengeance. His experience at the hands of his would-be murderer, maybe surprisingly, did nothing to change that. With the help of the American Civil Liberties Union, he even went to court to try and stop Franklin's execution. This, despite telling The Hollywood Reporter that he would love to have a single hour with the man, quote, with a pair of wire cutters and pliers so I could inflict the same damage on him that he inflicted on me, end quote. I'm sure he wasn't alone in that. When he died, Franklin was officially credited with murdering 15, severely injuring 6, and planting 3 bombs. It's highly likely he was responsible for more. To research this case, journalist Amy Wilson read The Killer's Shadow, The FBI's Hunt for a White Supremacist Serial Killer by John Douglas and Mark Olshaker, as well as Joseph Paul Franklin, The True Story of the Racist Killer by Jack Rosewood and Dwayne Walker. She found a few legal documents that included trial testimony and legal summaries written for appellate purposes, and she interviewed the always awesome Dan Horn. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're @centuriespod, and you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.